All right, and so a little review as we're looking at Philippians 2. The whole section we're looking at is from verse 5 through verse 11. Yesterday and again today, we're going to look particularly at Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 to 8. The section that, again, Philippians 2, 6 to 11 is a Christian hymn, which Paul is citing, and that he might also have made additions, emendations to, whatever, but that we have no way of telling. And this first stanza, verses 6 through 8, would be what is known as Christ's humiliation. And the two key verbs that are in there, Greek words, are kenosis and tapenomai. Kenosis literally means to pour out or empty. And again, in the translation, you see that sense of empty. Tapenomai, very interesting, literally means to level a mountain or hill. So in West Virginia, when they blow off the top of a mountain to level, you know, so they can get at the coal, right? What they're doing, and actually it's quite true, isn't it? They're humiliating the mountain, right? And so one way you can almost think about certain kinds of ecological exploitation is that it is really the humiliation of creation. But that's a whole other topic, and I won't get stuck on that. But the word means literally to level a mountain, and of course that is to make low. And that's where we get the word humble from. And the other thing that we looked at and that we're going to continue to work with very closely today is that as we look at chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, there is a pattern there that's although or because A, not B, but C. And that's the way Paul understands the work of Christ. That's the way Paul understands his work as an apostle. And that's the way we'll see Paul also understands our work as people of God. So, here's our review quiz question. The although A, not B, but C. How would you fill in A, B, C from Philippians 2, 6 to 8?
Although it is equal, that's the A.
Okay, so although form of God or equal to God, so far so good.
Did not count equality with God.
Take advantage of it.
Okay.
Not exploited
for his advantage. Good. But
emptied himself.
Emptied. And
humble.
Be humbled, died.
Okay. And we know under emptied and humbled, Paul develops that further. How did Jesus empty himself?
So he took the form, it wasn't the form of God, but the form of a slave. Right?
Okay.
Is that right?
So,
or no?
Yeah. So we've got, we'll work it this way. There's two forms there. First, the form of a human.
Yeah.
And if that's not bad enough, we're going to be a slave. And what comes in under humble?
Obedient.
Death.
And death.
Obedient. And if that's not bad enough, death. And if that's not bad enough,
death on a cross.
Right. So in other words, you see, as you work this way down, if we think about humiliation or make low, right, when you get down to death on a cross, you can't get any lower. That is just simply as low as you can go. And that, again, as we learned yesterday in terms of the whole notion, in terms of Roman understandings of things, that would be the course or the path of shame, as opposed to the course or the path. If you're the Roman emperor and you want to get to the top, what do you want to be called?
Augustus.
Augustus. So we see what Paul has going here is both, right, a theological understanding of God and Christ that turns all of our theology upside down, topsy-turvy. And it's also a political statement in terms of the whole Roman way of honor as opposed to the way of shame, right? What you want to do is you want to get to be Augustus, or at least on that path with Augustus. And remember, what that path is you do an act of piety, latrine duty, and then you wage a war, and then you win a war. And, you know, you have to be victorious, and then you can boast that you bring about the peace of Rome. So if you can't be the emperor and do all that, at least what you want to do is maybe be a soldier in the army, because if you wage war and you're on the winning side, there's a lot of honor that goes with that. Whereas this way, right, nobody's going to be calling Jesus a hero. So that's that whole topsy-turvy world, but the way in which Paul understands who Christ is for us, and as we'll see, who God is for us, and this formula or pattern, although or because A, not B, but C, is this way of emptying and humbling. Okay, so today we're going to look at some of the other places in Scripture where Paul works on this kind of thing. One more thing here that I didn't bring up yesterday, but I want to bring up now, something I think that's important. That Christ became obedient, even obedient to death. That Christ is obedient to death is indicative of God's freedom and love for us. Why? Because human beings are not free to choose death. Even though I would like to, I can't really say here and say, well, I just want you folks to know that I've chosen not to die. And so, you know, so you all know, so, you know, Cindy for program and everything, you know that I will be an eternal teaching staff person, because see, I'm not going to die. I choose not to die.
Except I won't be, so you'll have to make arrangements with the
future. Okay, well, however you want, if you choose to die, so be it, right? Right, it's ridiculous, right? For us as human beings, death is a necessity. We have no choice. We're going to die. It's inevitable. Not so. Right? Christ, this part of his obedience to death, right, is that indeed, again, this is part of the path he chose for us. This is part of God's freedom. God is so free to love that God will go to the death for us. Doesn't have to. It's not necessary. It's not inevitable. And you would say, why would God do that? Love. Right. So that point about obedience there. as part of that humbling is also important in terms of showing God's freedom and love. Okay, I wanted to say that because that's too important.
So to bring that to relevance to today, the Christian understanding of life stands radically against the American way.
Yeah, it really does.
And we want to call ourselves a Christian nation. This stands absolutely against what we talk about.
That's right. So, I mean, that's a lot of food for thought for us as individuals and certainly as churches, both as congregations and as larger organizations, to say, what's the ways in which we practice good citizenship? And what are the ways in which we seek social justice? Or in that sense, we even go beyond that to say, yes, justice is a good thing. I'm not against justice. But at least from this perspective, you would say, but there's got to be more than justice. There is the sense of compassion.
But I think it even calls into question how we function as a congregation. We're forever trying to be successful.
Well, sure.
Which has nothing to do with what this is talking about, the cruciform.
Yeah, I know, I always kind of, some of the, being around for a while in the 70s and 80s, some of the church growth programs they had and all of that kind of stuff. And the thing is how they kind of always used Jesus as the model for church growth. And I think about that, and you go, well, how many followers did Jesus have on Good Friday? Right? It's not a really great church growth model, is it? But, I just couldn't quite figure that out. I let it pass me by. You're right, there are a whole way in which we think about organizing congregations, how we live with one another, what it means to be a community of faith is not, kind of the model of, let's say, adopting a constitution similar to the U.S. Constitution and voting in this, that, and the other. Community of faith doesn't really quite work that way. So yeah, lots to think about. All right, let's look at a few passages here where Paul might also be working with this formula or this pattern. The first one I'd like you to look at is 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9. And anyone who finds that, please read it for us. And I want the rest of you then to say, okay, what's there about what's the A, B, and C in that passage? And remember what I said on Monday, if you were here, Paul sometimes gets really excited and skips some of the things he wants to say, so perhaps an A, B, or C might be missing. But you folks who are biblically smart and Pauline experts will know how to supply the ABCs because we've worked that through in Philippians. So, okay, 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9.
For you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich.
All right.
Well, this is a hard one.
What's the A?
Rich.
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 What's the B?
Poor.
Poor.
Became poor.
Not poor.
No.
No.
No. No. No. That's the C thing.
C is poor.
Though he was rich.
He chose not
so
to.
So he chose not to. Yeah, he chose not to be rich.
But isn't that a status?
He's
the generous act.
You're right. A is rich. B is poor.
I mean, C is poor.
Or, I'm sorry, C is poor. But he doesn't really quite tell us B here. So now what do we think? The whole part here is, what does Paul mean by rich? That's right, it doesn't mean wealthy. What does Paul mean by rich?
He had everything, huh?
Well, what about in he was in communion with God?
Okay. The word in there, I think it's in the NRSV, generosity.
Right, generous act.
Okay. What? How does that maybe help us understand rich?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if he was rich, he was full of generosity, or again, that word for generosity in Greek would be the grace.
Because that's a footnote in the NRSV.
Oh, that says grace?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, there, see? So the footnote is helping you out. So although Christ was full of grace, or we might even say full of God's grace, not what? Didn't exploit it, or I would say again, working with generosity, didn't hoard it.
Yeah, gave it, yeah, lavish.
Didn't say, ooh, I've got all the grace, it's all mine, goody, 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 and right, neener, 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 to all you guys, no, did not hoard God's grace or generosity, but what? Here we could put in our kenosis. Poured it all out on us who were poor, so that he becomes poor and we become rich. In other words, full of grace.
So that we might not hoard it.
Well, that's...
Yeah. There we go, yeah.
That's, I mean, if we want to now say, plug that in for us, right, we would do the same thing. Now, because we, from God, have received the fullness of God's grace, we are not to exploit or hoard that for ourselves, but pour it out for the sake of others.
Wow.
Precisely. That's how Paul would say, see, how that works for
yeah,
Christ,
exactly.
How that works for us.
Yeah, and I was thinking, rich, full of grace, and so we don't think we're the in crowd, but we pour it out. Because oftentimes that's kind of what happens too. We're in, you're out.
I would describe that as the key to life. God has created us, created all things for that very purpose. Not just even created all things for that very purpose. That's the secret of all of life.
I would say that this is the nature of grace itself. Like once grace is even thought of to be hoarded, it's not grace anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, transforms.
It must be movable. It must be continuous.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's the sense grace cannot be a possession. We don't have grace, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And it can't be stagnant. I like that flowing thing. It can't be stagnant and, like you said, hoarded.
Right. It's,
well, the pouring. Pouring out, like the receiving of the poor, pouring it away from ourselves.
Right, yeah.
really wonderful.
And of course, this whole pouring out, this metaphor or this way of talking about pouring out is always used, or I shouldn't say, is often used when we're talking about which person of the Spirit, of the Trinity.
Spirit.
It didn't die. Right? The Spirit. Right? It's always God pouring out the Spirit. But, you know, I think sometimes we forget or don't bring into that notion that this is really this is this emptying act, right? It is God giving of God's self in our behalf.
Which is way different than poking a hole in the jug and making the water pour out. I mean, we kind of try and force with laws and stuff. I don't know, it's just...
Yeah.
No,
that's... It's like kind of overflowing from the... Yeah.
Has to be coming of its volition from the source.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Than taking.
Yeah, because again, this pouring out, right, the subject of that action is God. Right, so it's not that, you know, we poke a hole in the container so that we can get it. No, it is graciously poured out upon us. Yeah. Okay, one other thing about this verse.
Just had a random image that goes with that. When you're breastfeeding an infant, if you just hear that baby cry, there's a response in you that does pour out your milk for that baby, that's part of that sustainability thing too. It doesn't happen when you hear a puppy cry. It happens when you hear your child cry. Mm-hmm. And you're really sensitized to that.
And you're in the middle of the grocery store,
yes.
You forgot to put extra.
Or other babies
cry.
Yes. It's an infant crying.
It's an infant crying.
Right.
I have to admit that has been part of my experience. I will take your word for it. To be sure.
The other biblical picture is the Peter, James, and John with Jesus on the mountaintop. You don't stay there and soak it up.
Right.
You go back down.
Build. You don't build. Yeah.
It's build houses and stay here.
Yeah, build tents or whatever. Yeah.
Well, what's clashing in my brain is our judicial system. I know we're supposed to go somewhere, but I'm saying we've created laws and a judicial system of prerequisite decisions that somehow are supposed to solve the guilty or non-guilty or, you know, whatever. The decision is made by taking someone else's, forcing a decision. As, you know, when we watched some of Bonnie Drews did a Vespers where she was showing some of the folks from Rwanda who are standing side by side with the people who had killed their family members, you know, the restorative justice idea where they're actually communicating and by choice are pouring out something inside of them that allows life to move on, but it wasn't said, you must forgive this person, or no, it wasn't like that, it doesn't go that way. But.
And so what we've got here again too, picking up on that, is what Paul will talk about in other places as reconciliation. Because that's precisely what reconciliation involves, isn't it? Again, reconciliation is an experience. And it is something that to be reconciled with someone else, there has to be an emptying. And in that sense, graciousness has to flow.
You also throw in the Old Testament concept, blessed to be a blessing.
Yeah. The last thing I want to say about this passage, 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9, Luther liked it a lot. And he said from this passage, he gets his notion of the freiliches Wechsel, the glorious exchange, or the happy exchange, where he says, Christ becomes who we are so we can become who Christ is. And again, in terms of the title for this week, that's where I get the notion of cruciformity from. right? Cruciform Christ, cruciform God, and as we've just talked about it here, cruciform church. And we can take it right down to the individuals, that all of us are going to be conformed, transformed to the crucified, cruciform Christ. That's the dynamics, that's the experience in Paul. Let's go on to a way that Paul understands it. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 6 to 8. And again, if someone has that, 1 Thessalonians 2, 6 to 8, please read it for us and then we'll do our ABCs.
Nor did we seek praise from mortals, whether from you or from others, though we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. But we were gentle among you, like a nurse tenderly caring for her own children. So deeply do we care for you that we are determined to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you have become very dear to us.
Okay. So, what's the A?
Making demands.
Nope.
Like, we are worthy of praise as apostles of Christ.
Because we're apostles of Christ. Yeah.
We'll just... Although apostles of Christ...
We did not seek glory from men.
Right. Here's the right. Not
demands.
Right. Praise, glory. Here's Steph. Here's where the demands come in. Right.
Yeah.
I'm a Bible study leader, so be nice to me. Take me out for ice cream. Not. Right.
Yep.
Not praise, glory, demands, but...
Could be gentle among you like a nursing mother.
Yeah.
That's why.
See, Penny cheated. She looked ahead and gave
well,
us an example.
I think it was a prophetic thing.
Before we even talked about it.
I didn't have the paper for it.
No, you're prophetic. You was prophetic.
Shared her own selves.
So we'll just say, gentle nurse, what else is in there? Shared?
Share our own self.
Yeah, not only the gospel, but our very lives.
Okay, right. And yeah, there again, note, shared gospel and lives. Right, the great thing about that, and think about it, is Paul's understanding is that for each and every one of us, we too are embodiments or incarnations of the gospel. So again, Paul is saying, when I look at you, sisters and brothers in Christ, I should see a living, breathing gospel. Because that's who you are. And of course, that is one that will be poured out and humbled for the sake of all. Right? So you see how Paul uses, right here he used this pattern for Christ. Here he uses this pattern for himself. Exact same thing. Although A, not B, right? And usually in all the other places we could look, the not B is always that notion about, you know, hey, I'm an apostle. But I'm not going to use that. I'm not going to do that. Another place, again, and time isn't going to let us look at all of this, but I'll just give you the reference here. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 12 to 23. 1 Corinthians 9, 12 to 23. And let me paraphrase that that for you to see how that. What he's saying there is saying, although as an apostle I was free and had the right to take a wife along with me and the right to be paid for my ministry, I did not make use of any of these apostolic rights. But I enslaved myself to all in multiple ways, including self-support and adaptability to different kinds of people. Hmm. Right, and this is the one, for those who were weak, I became weak, those strong, I became strong, all that. In other words, part of the but is that sense of adaptability, right? Inclusiveness, welcome, hospitality. I would say hospitality is always part of the C. Because you do have to pour yourself out to be hospitable, right? Because if you're truly an apostle, and perhaps take that a little too seriously, after all, as an apostle, you're the one who does it right. And everybody should do it the way you do it. But Paul never says, do it my way. What he's going to say is, he will say, be an imitator of me, but then as I am an imitator of Christ. So in other words, when you work that through, it's always be an imitator of Christ. It is always use this formula. Although or because A, not B, but C. Okay? All right, let's work on one more. And this is going to be how it applies to us. And this is 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 to 7. And again, if someone gets that, if they would read it for us, and I think you might be surprised.
Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things.
Good, thank you. Okay. When do most of you hear this passage read?
Weddings.
Oh, isn't that so sad? Mm-hmm. I'm one of those that belong to the club. Never use this passage at a wedding.
We're proud to say we did not use this passage at a wedding.
Good.
Just to be clear.
Because in some senses, it's so much deeper than that. I mean, if you will, this is a wonderful text for, let's say, Confirmation Sunday, right? Because again, we can work our way through all the, there's not a lot of A in there. That's kind of been assumed because, again, we have been loved by God. Let's put it in shorthand, right? Then again, we've got all sorts of, if that's the case, then there's all sorts of nots, buts, right? And as you read through that, you get a whole list, don't you? Love is not, but, So you've got this whole paradigm pattern, and this is, in that sense, the most extended piece in Paul's letters, where he fully develops this, although A not B, but C, for us as people of God and what it means.
Right. Does the Roman concept of love have these elements? Or what? How does that work?
The Roman?
You mean like agape versus phileo and all that kind of stuff? Or?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, he's defining what love is, but what was love before that?
Okay. Within the culture and within the context of both kind of Greek and Roman philosophy, there is love that is for pleasure, love that is, we'll say, pragmatic, and then love that is genuine. Love that is for pleasure, well, the easiest example there is sex.
Eros.
Eros. Love that is pragmatic is in terms of, usually understood with regard to business. Right? You love, you kind of care for your business partners and everything. And, you'll love this one. Basically understood in terms of the love a husband should have for his wife. Well, I mean, it's pragmatic because after all, she's going to have your children and keep the household in order. So the kind of love to make sure she does a good job at that is a very pragmatic kind of thing, right?
And you do a good job supporting her as she's doing.
And again, if you're pragmatic in the sense there of loving, you would support the one who raises your children, especially your sons. Yeah. And you'd want her to train your daughters in this same style so that, you know, you'll be able to marry them off. The good old days, right? No. No, I didn't even say that. Erase that, please. Okay. Genuine love is basically understood as friendship. And at least according to the philosophers, all the Stoics, but even Aristotle, we'll just toss this up. How many genuine friends can you have? Take a guess. I don't expect it, but just for fun. How many genuine friends do you think one can have?
Say five.
Seven?
Did one.
Nope.
Wow.
Two.
Oh,
two. Wow. Two. Three was close. Two. Because I guess there again, when you add yourself to it, there's three, and so that's a good staple number, right? But two. Now, what is a true friend according to Aristotle? And we get a little sense of that notion of friendship from John's gospel.
Somebody who dated a kidney for you?
Right. Yeah. The kind of person who is so close to you that they are virtually your own self. That it is such a case, Aristotle would say, that with regard to your own soul, your own psyche, your own anima, you have a friend such that you are only half your soul and your friend is the other half. And the two of you together make the complete person.
So in John, no greater love, is that?
That's precisely the notion of what genuine friendship would be. No greater love would anyone have than that they would give their life for their friend.
That's David and Jonathan too, the relationship David and Jonathan.
Yeah. That would be the Hellenistic understanding of what love is. And again, as you can see, there's not a lot of this genuine stuff around.
But the Christian love, or the love of Christ, the love of God, goes beyond that. And the definition that anybody around me very much has heard is to do what is necessary and helpful and beneficial for the other person, whether they deserve it or not. And Paul's kind of getting at that in this, in 1 Corinthians 13.
Yes. Yep. And again, right, I mean, one of the key things that distinguishes that Christian understanding of love from the cultural understanding is the whether they deserve it or not, the whole unconditionality. Hmm. Right. We don't attach conditions. Even here, under genuine friendship, there are still all sorts of kind conditions, right? I mean, you have to be simpatico. You have to have the same kind of goals and interests and cares. You have to take an interest in one another and so on and so forth, right? Again, genuine friendship is a lot of work. Aristotle says you can only have a genuine friend if indeed you get together and meet and talk with each other every day. And interestingly enough, again, given this designation here, certainly the Hellenistic world never considered a wife your friend. There you go.
What a loss.
Yeah, I know.
So today's soulmate just wouldn't cut it.
No, that didn't cut it. Becky.
I don't know how this ties in, but when Daryl said that, like, you know, you do whatever is good and necessary for the other person, even if they don't deserve it. When we were talking about grace and the generous, like, does it matter? Like, if it's, I'm consciously deciding to do this for you, even though you don't deserve it, and internally I don't want to do it, or does it, or as opposed to, like, just running in front of a bus to get a kid or something like that, where you just do it, and kind of what you were saying about like puncturing holes, like, because I know that I've done acts, but I haven't wanted to do them, you know, and then maybe there's the other kind as well. So anyway, does that have anything to do with this?
In some sense, right? I mean, there's the saying of Jesus, of course, that your right hand should know what your left hand is doing, But I mean, it doesn't mean that the sense of Christian love is you're just totally unthinking about it. I think what we're getting at here again is the understanding about pouring out, about, let's say again, that notion of obedient to that, right? To say obedient to love is a sense of showing the freedom we now have such that we are not going to impose conditions, laws, rules, regulations upon folks, right? So that, for example, right, in Saskatoon, one of my buddies who happens to run a crack house, when he gets in trouble, I'm going to help him anyway, knowing that will my helping and saying, you know, you got to get out of this stuff. Is he really going to do that? Probably not. Does that mean, oh, don't help him anymore, to say, unless you, you know, clean up your life, don't come to me anymore? You don't know. And you help them, and so then, and some folks have said, well, you know, you're just stupid. You know, he's taking advantage of you. No, I don't think I'm stupid. I know what I'm doing. Is he taking advantage of me? Maybe. But so what? It's a person who really needs help. And who knows? One day, we may be able to clean things up in his life, right? I mean, I think that's the stuff that's going on.
I think it's always a struggle to know what truly is helpful.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. And you could come down on both sides of that in an attempt to be helpful. And to the question of the automation of this, the more we are involved, involved in the spirit, in the place where the spirit connects, or worship, prayer, Christian fellowship, and all that kind of stuff, this kind of stuff here, the more you are involved in that, the more likely it becomes absolutely automatic. You just do it. Other people, what are you doing? I don't know, I'm just doing what I'm supposed to be doing. This is where I live, you know. So it becomes a both and, but it becomes more and more automatic the deeper you fall into God's presence.
Mm-hmm. I love that phrase, obedient to love, because then that erases a lot of those conditions and judgments or things that you might make, but you're obedient to love, and you don't have to understand everything. You're just obedient to love.
I know one good pastor friend of mine who's very involved in social justice and issues like that, was asked once by somebody, what's the whole point of your ministry? How would you summarize that? What's your goal? And he just said, that we be kind to one another. Mm. There you go, right? So do you know what you're doing? Don't you know what you're doing? Conditions not, I don't know, be kind to one another.
Although we have heard about grace and love being poured upon us, we're not able to totally attain perfection in that realm because we're human. But we need to continually live by example, and sometimes we get it right, or you know, we continually need to go back to the drawing board and hear it again and again and again and again. I mean, the same.
Mm-hmm.
Formula.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, right, and I'm going to stop because our time's up here, but just one way, if we have a little more time to think it through, for you to think it through, I think where this again applies to us is if we say, I'll give you the A, right? Although or because I am a baptized child of God, right? Then to say, okay, what's the not B but C? And you can work those out for yourself, right? That's how you're going to live out your Christian life. But I think again, right, this for us is the big given, right? That we are baptized children of God. That's our status. That's secure. That's the for sure. Right? Given that, not B, but C. Mm. You fill in the blanks.
Can you go back? Yeah, I would say one step further. Because I have been created by God. Because I have been given life.
Sure.
We don't think of it in this way. But there is nothing that we have experienced in life that hasn't been a gift.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can take it back to that, right? The sense that all of our life is graced. All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And again, you can keep the Philippians sheet if you want, or just put it back on the stack, and we'll use them again tomorrow as we start working our way into verses 9 through 11.
Well, you really meant it when you said you were going to stay on those verses all week, didn't you?
You bet!
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks.